Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
This is Tom Hartman.
And every time Rush Limbaugh hears that theme music, he ups his meds.
Now, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom in the American way. What is rational tax policy in the United States or anywhere else? You know, we did our show from Copenhagen, Denmark, 2 weeks ago. A very interesting place with some very interesting tax policies. We can talk about those. Dr. Edgar Browning is a professor of economics at Texas A&M, one of the most widely quoted and published economists in the country in government programs and tax policies. His new book, Stealing from Each Other, is the title. Dr. Browning, welcome to our program.
Thank you.
Glad to have you with us. You suggest that tax policies, progressive tax policies, are a form of theft. Why?
Well, if a private individual takes money that's earned by someone else and uses it, we would call it stealing. And I don't think it's too much of a stretch to say when the government does it, a la Robin Hood, that we should also consider it as a form of stealing.
So if I walk into a 7-Eleven and pick up a candy bar and take a bite out of it and then put it back on the shelf, am I justified in doing that?
No.
Then why are you suggesting that I should take the benefits of government in the United States, my free public education, the highway systems, the infrastructure, the protection of the air and water supply, and say, yeah, I'm not going to pay for that. I'm going to let my children and grandchildren pay for it. We'll put it on the national credit card.
Well, I don't say that. I mean, basically, the theme of the book is that government redistributive policies are very expensive in ways that people often don't realize. We transfer each year, mostly through government programs, $1 trillion each year to low-income families. And the question is, what are the consequences of that? Have we gotten a good return on that spending? That's an immense amount of money.
Well, first of all, you're suggesting in using those numbers, you're including things like Medicare and Social Security, all of which people paid into. That's money that we're essentially paying ourselves back.
That's not exactly true. As you know, Social Security and Medicare are not investment programs. They are programs that transfer money from...
No, they're insurance policies. They're not transfer policies. They're insurance policies.
No, they are transfer policies. They take money every year from workers, and that money is not put into a trust fund. It's paid out immediately to people who are retired. It's a transfer program. That's the most important
thing. Only two-thirds of Social Security is paid to retired persons. A third of it is paid to literally widows, orphans, and the disabled. Social Security is an insurance program. It was set up as an insurance program. It's always been an insurance program. It's essentially like a pension program. You get it for the rest of your life in the retirement part.
Well, that's the way.
But looking at, you're talking about $1 trillion in welfare. I just don't see where that money is. I mean, I'm looking at our national defense. You know, is 19.7% of our budget, $521 billion federal expenditures. But interest on the debt is 8.5%. But health is only 2.8%. Veterans benefits 2.6%. Unemployment 1.3%. I mean, where is this giant welfare that you're talking about?
Well, $620 billion of it is in the form of about 80 different welfare programs. The remainder of it is...
Are you including in that Social Security and Medicare?
No, that in that figure.
Well, I'm looking at the federal budget here, and I don't see... You know, family support is 0.8%. You know, housing progress, 0.7%.
Well, some of the welfare programs wouldn't be included in those things, like the food stamp program is in the Department of Agriculture. But this is not a number I'm making up.
That program is $53.9 billion. That's 2% of our federal budget.
Okay, but this is not all federal welfare that I'm talking about. This is federal, state, and local spending on welfare programs adds up to over $600 billion each year. And in addition to that, a large part of the expenditures under Social Security and Medicare go to low-income families. I'm not including total spending in the trillion.
Okay, well, let's get out of the micro into the macro for a moment.
Okay.
You say no country has ever redistributed its way to prosperity. I was just in Denmark, where the minimum wage is $38,000 a year, and people earning that minimum wage are paying a tax rate of about 24%. The person earning an average wage of around $78,000 a year is paying an average tax rate of around 34%. If you make over $2 million a year, then you start paying over 60% in taxes. That country is clearly redistributing wealth, and it is one of the most prosperous nations on Earth.
Okay. All of the nations, well, nations like Denmark became wealthy before they were redistributing all this amount of income.
No, Denmark has been doing this since 1848.
Well, in 1960, the 17 wealthiest countries in the world spent about 27% of national income through government. And the United States was also 27% in 1960. What happened between 1960 and 1980 is that the wealthy countries greatly expanded their welfare states, and that was the period when you got the big spending in Denmark, Sweden, England, Germany, France, and so on. What's happened since 1980, once they expanded to that degree, those countries have fallen further and further behind the U.S. I mean, if you want to look at the consequences of this.
How has Denmark fallen behind us? They have free health care. They have free education all the way up to the level of PhD. They're the happiest country in the world by half a dozen different studies, one just 2 weeks ago in the British Medical Journal.
They have fallen behind us in terms of income per person. In 1980, the Western European economies had incomes that were about 85% as large as ours. Today,
you're talking median or average income.
Average income.
So because Denmark doesn't have any Bill Gates. Dr. Browning, I mean this is a game that you're playing. I mean this is like if you and me are in a bar and our average income, if we took our combined incomes and averaged it might be $100,000 a year. Bill Gates walks into the room, suddenly our average income is billions of dollars. That a country where wealth is so unevenly distributed and that has a large number of billionaires, of course it's going to shift your averages. Denmark may have a lower average, but the working people of Denmark are actually making more than working people in America.
Well, I am not familiar with Denmark. I am more familiar with countries like Italy and France and so on, and they have fallen further behind us. And if they continue, I mean, the point is that you can only redistribute wealth if you produce it. And if you don't produce it, you're going to have more average wealth.
Okay, in that context, you suggest, you wrote a piece called Let's Cut Taxes on the Rich. And you say, am I the only one who thinks the rich are overtaxed relative to the middle class? You say, first, the rich provide most of the capital that is used in the American economy and that makes us all more productive as workers. My understanding is that the majority of jobs, and this is from federal statistics from the Bush administration, the majority of new jobs created over the last 35 years in the United States were created by companies with fewer than 50 employees. That is to say, it started by entrepreneurs, by and large, people who are not rich, people who are starting companies on a shoestring, on a credit card.
Well, I don't know that they're starting them on a shoestring, but again, what you just quoted is true, that the wealthy people own, provide about 70% of the capital that's used in businesses in the U.S., and that makes us all more productive. It makes workers
more productive. No, I'm saying how does it make us more productive?
Because think of how productive you would be if you didn't have any broadcasting equipment. That's capital. If there were fewer buildings or vehicles or computers, these things.
Okay, perhaps we're confusing things. Why does it matter? If I become more productive and my wages are cut in half, why is that a social good?
Well, if you become more productive, you would probably be paid more. I mean,
That's not how it's worked in the United States. Wages have been going down ever since Reagan became president, and your kind of economic policies were put into place.
No, they haven't been going down.
In real inflation-adjusted terms, average wages, I'm not talking earnings from dividends and interest, average wages in the United States have steadily declined.
That's simply untrue. There are two reasons why those sorts of numbers are put out. One is that they use a wrong inflation adjustment. If they use the same one that they use in the national accounts, the personal consumption expenditure thing, wages have gone up. And those figures also do not
include... But then so has the cost of everything else.
Those figures do not include fringe benefits, which have gone up very much. Wages in the middle, if you adjust correctly for inflation and for fringe benefits, middle-income families are making more now than they were in 1980.
Then why are they so behind? You want to continue the conversation? Can you stick around for another few minutes?
Sure.
Okay, we got to take about a four-minute break here, and then we'll have another 6 or 8 minutes. We can wrap this up. We're talking with Dr. Edgar Browning, and also let us know if there's a website to promote your book. Stealing from Each Other is his new book. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person?
Past the hour. 21%. I got my brains in too many numbers. Dr. Edgar Browning is with us, the author of Stealing from Ourselves. Stealing from Each Other, excuse me. And Dr. Browning, welcome back. You say, secondly, the rich also provide highly skilled labor services to the country. Bill McGuire was paid $1.78 billion for his 10 years as CEO of United Healthcare, the company that is supposed to be providing us with healthcare. What justifies an income of $112,500 a minute?
Well, I have no idea. I didn't pay that income to him. The board of directors or stockholders chose that income. I think it's really, I mean, if you want to pick on people who have very high incomes, it's true that we've got a lot of people in this country who have extremely high incomes, but
do you disagree with Thomas Jefferson's statement that we should beware of overblown wealth that can threaten the state?
Well, I don't think it threatens the state. As long as you've got thousands of people who have very high incomes, that's a testament to the prosperity of the country that their people can do this. They didn't.
But we've got a few thousand people with billions of dollars, and we've got tens of millions of people with virtually nothing. How is that a good thing?
Tens of millions of people with virtually nothing?
Yeah, you've got 50 million people who can't even afford health insurance.
Let's talk about that. There are 47 million people who are uninsured in this country, the most recent numbers I've seen. Fully one-third of those people have incomes over $50,000 a year. Another third of them are eligible for government-provided health care, but that they simply haven't signed up yet. 25% of them are not American citizens at all. They're immigrants, including illegal immigrants. It's not true that there are millions, 50 million people who can't afford health insurance.
I would submit to you that without being able to verify your statistics, I would submit to you that regardless of whether people are insured or uninsured, the number of people in this country who are underinsured is huge and significant. And still, you're saying, again, your quote, second, the rich also provide highly skilled labor services to the economy, and therefore we shouldn't tax them.
I don't say you shouldn't tax them, please.
We shouldn't overtax them.
Well, while you're talking about this, let's just make clear that the top 5% of incomes of families in terms of their income in this country, that starts at $189,000 before taxes a year. We're not talking, I mean, the number of people there who have million-dollar incomes are only about 0.2%.
Yeah, looking at Kevin Phillips' numbers, you know, from Wealth and Democracy, and Kevin Phillips is no slouch, and you know, and also a Republican. He says personal wealth grew by 75% between 1983 and 2004. Okay, that sounds pretty good, but only 1.2% of that growth occurred among the 60% of wage earners. Over 60% of that growth occurred among the richest 5%, and 75% of that growth among the richest 10%. The group that saw, and then he says, between the end of World War II and the 1970s, the group that saw the greatest growth was the bottom quintile, which grew 120%, and the top 20% only saw their income grow by 90%. In other words, during the period from the beginning of the New Deal until essentially the end of the New Deal with Reagan, all Americans' income were growing and growing steadily. Since Reagan, the very wealthy's income is growing really rapidly, and average wage earners, to the extent that their wealth may be growing at all, it's growing, you know, 1.2%.
Well, that's
I would say this is a direct consequence of the fact that Reagan dropped the top marginal tax rate from 71% down to 28%.
Well, certainly that encouraged people at the top to earn more. That was part of the intent of that, and they end up paying more taxes, as you know.
Right, and one of the ways that they earn more is by paying working people less or shipping their jobs overseas.
That's nonsense. I was just while on break here, since we were talking about what happened to people in the middle of the income distribution, I have a paper in front of me that corrects the hourly wage figures for the inflation problem and for fringe benefits, and it concludes that the median hourly wage in America has risen by 28% between 1975 and 2005.
Well, you know, on the other hand, I've got figures from the CBO that say wages and salaries are now the lowest share of GDP since 1929. It's like, you know, dueling figures. I think the average American, though, looks around and says, hey, wait a minute, I'm not doing as good as I was doing 15, 20 years ago. 20, 30 years ago, people could raise a family with a single income.
Well, I'm sympathetic to that problem, certainly, but the solution to it isn't to simply shift money around from some people to other people.
Why don't we just go back to the taxation system we had under Eisenhower? He was all in favor of it. He was a Republican. It worked very well.
Well, it's not so clear that it worked all that well. I mean,
it built the American middle class.
Economists who've studied the income tax system think it's responsible for reducing our incomes by about 10%. Currently, that is. And I don't.
How are we going to pay for the infrastructure of governance that we all agree we want if we don't pay taxes?
Oh, I'm all in favor of paying taxes for infrastructure. I'm not so much in favor of paying taxes to have money taken from the taxpayers and given to other people, and that's 60% of the federal budget.
Okay, Dr. Edgar Browning, professor of economics at Texas A&M, his new book, Stealing from Each Other. Dr. Browning, thanks for the discussion.
Thank you.
Appreciate you dropping by. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Give us a call at 866-303-2270.
Minutes past the hour. Here's the radical concept. Let me just lay this out. This is what makes people like Rush Limbaugh crazy. And then we'll pick up your phone calls at 866-303-2270. And that is that, yes, redistributing income, redistributing wealth beyond a certain point is a healthy thing for society. We actually used to have a social consensus about that. Americans used to agree on that. Dwight Eisenhower, the Republican president, agreed on it. The Republican Congress, by and large, agreed on it. That there is a certain point where when individuals start amassing wealth beyond a certain point, that it starts, it introduces into society disequilibriums, that they become, as Thomas Jefferson said, a threat to a free state. They have so much power and wealth that they can influence government, that they can influence policy, that they can buy essentially towns, that they can buy elections, that they can get ballot initiatives on in states, that they can change laws, that they become a force unto themselves, and that that's not a good thing. And so when we saw that happen in the United States, and it first started happening in the 1860s, the first 50, 60, 70 years of this country, we didn't have that kind of wealth. And it happened during the robber baron era after the Civil War, and the robber barons started to emerge, and that kind of wealth rose up, and we saw these dynastic families emerge, the Mellons and the Rockefellers and the Goulds, the Jay Gould, the railroad families and whatnot. And Teddy Roosevelt said there's something fundamentally wrong with this, and put into place an inheritance tax. And then Franklin Roosevelt came along, FDR, and said, you know, let's say if you're going to earn $3.2 million in today's dollars, no problem. You make more than that, and at that point we're saying, you know, you really don't need more than $3.2 million a year to live, so you're going to pay a 90% income tax beyond that. And the result wasn't that people stopped working, and the result wasn't that they stopped making businesses. In fact, during that period of time, from that 91% tax, from 1935 till 1963, and then 71% up until 1980 with Reagan, so we might as well say from the 30s until the 80s, we saw the emergence of very, very few, I can frankly think of none, dynastic families, huge dynastic wealth. But what we did see was the emergence of a strong and powerful and broadly based middle class. And then Reagan did away with that progressive taxation and said, no, it's a wonderful thing if you have billionaires in America and multi-billionaires in America. That's a fine thing. That shows how rich we all are. And what happened? We've all gotten poorer. And I'll just say it right up front. I am all in favor of redistributing wealth above a certain point. I think below that point, I think, you know, for the working people, the average working people in the United States, we should pay our way, as it were. I mean, we should be paying taxes that basically cover the cost of health care in the commons. But for the very, very wealthy above us, among us, there should be taxes. You're not going to hear any politicians say this. There should be taxes that say, okay, above that point, you know, that money is going to go to build the society. And that's how it was in this country until Reagan came along, and that's how it still is in most of the rest of the developed world, even though most Americans don't realize it. 866-303-2270, our number. Bill in Milwaukee. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Hey, Bill. Tom, I always listen to your program. I really enjoy you for the information you give and how well-informed you are, and I really feel like I gained things. What I really wanted to say is that my one-year anniversary for retiring was July 3rd, was my last day of working, 2007, mm-hmm. and I was able to retire at 58 years old because I had a union job, because I owned my own home and had it paid for, a home that I was able to buy on my own in 1977 mm-hmm. on a warehouseman's wage.
Yeah.
And I also have a defined benefit pension. That was what enabled me to also retire.
Which means you'll get a fixed amount of money for the rest of your life, no matter how long
that
is.
And it was a significant amount. Improvements that were made through negotiations and multipliers, some of which I didn't understand. During that time, I was able to buy the home, buy a boat, a nice ski boat, a motorcycle, take trips to Hawaii, and do all these things and pay cash mm-hmm. as a working person, blue collar.
Right.
And subsequent to that, people that came on in recent years where I was working in this union warehouse job, those people, they can't afford to buy homes with the money they're making. In fact, one of the guys is in his late 30s, I'm no 40, and he's making over $20 an hour, has a good benefit package, although it's always threatened at each negotiations because of the rising costs. And with a good union job, making over $20 an hour, with comprehensive health care, he is in a position with on his income, with the cost of housing now relative to wages, he can't afford to buy a home.
Yeah.
When I bought my home, it was like about $40,000. And the interest rate then, by the way, was on the way going up. And I had to pay like 9% interest.
Yeah.
But even then, the payments were minuscule. In fact, I didn't understand the idea economically of paying more than just the amount that I could pay more on the principal. I could have paid my house off sooner, but I didn't grasp that. I just grasped, you know, having fun.
Yeah. I get it, Bill. And the bottom line, and this is why I opened the opening chapter of my book, Screwed, is all about my dad, whose story was very similar to yours. He worked for 40 years in a tool and die shop, in a union shop, and because he worked in a union shop, he was able to raise four boys, put us through school to the extent that, you know, any of us were able and willing to do so, which was a whole other thing. We had health insurance our entire lives, you know, good Blue Cross Blue Shield back when the state of Michigan required health insurance companies to be not-for-profit companies, and the hospitals were all not-for-profit hospitals by law. And we had, I mean, I remember doctors coming to the house in the 50s and 60s. We, you know, they made house calls. He retired on a pension. My mother is still getting some of that pension. My dad died 2 years ago. That was the American dream. And that American dream, and Bill, thank you for the call, that American dream has vanished. It's now called the European dream. And now in Europe, this is called neoliberalism, or we call it conservative economic policies or Reaganomics, is creeping across Europe. And now, like Sarkozy, you know, in France is going after the same thing. It's just, you know, the attack. Well, here, for example, this is from today's Wall Street Journal, front page of the Wall Street Journal. On a recent morning, Jacqueline Sermont and her husband, Guy, 77-year-old retired construction worker, headed for their daily mud wrap. The spa's rheumatism cures, thermal baths, and 13-minute deep tissue massage are all covered by France's national health care insurance. Transportation and lodging are too. They take good care of us here, said Mrs. Sermont, a frail 76-year-old with dyed red hair. Yeah, but Sarkozy wants to do away with that. It is nuts. Brad in Miami, Florida, listening on Wins. Hey, Brad.
Hey, how you doing, Tom? Hey, I agree with that caller before, is that, man, you are very impressive with your knowledge of what goes on in America. And I tell you, I am for redistributing the wealth, but taking some airbags, money like Rush Limbaugh, and redistribute it to someone like you who really, you know, deserve it.
Yeah, at what point? I mean, how many private planes do you need? How many houses do you need? John McCain has 8 houses. I mean, you know, at what point do you say, okay, wait a minute, this is starting to look like a sickness. This is starting to look like mental illness.
It is. That's exactly what it is. But, and it's just an acute lack of concern for the other 300 million people that are around them. You know,
right. And not just the other, yeah, exactly. Well said, Brad. Thank you very much. And not just the other 300 million people. Consider worldwide. The top 1% of the world's population, that's 37 million adults with a net worth of just over $500,000. That top 1% own 40% of all the wealth in the world. The 50% of the world's population owns only 1.1% of the world's wealth. Rich in Connecticut. Hey, Rich.
Hey. The issue of how much you pay in taxes is really irrelevant if the government, and that's state, local, and federal, continue to grow at a much higher rate than the economy in general.
Depends on what they're doing.
Well, no. If you look at it, even if you balance the budget, if the government grows at 8% a year and the economy grows at only 4%, if you stretch out the timeline to 80 years from now, your entire check that you take.
Right, you've got a disaster. No, but Rich, consider this. When the government was growing in the 30s and early 40s, mostly through, well, let's take the 30s as an example. When the government was growing, principally through building bridges and dams and schools and hospitals and roads, that growth, that government growth, it was a staging area for the growth of industry throughout the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. We're still using those bridges and roads and dams that were built in the 30s with a massive expansion of government. On the other hand, the Soviet Union isn't a relevant case here. On the other hand, when Reagan spent trillions of dollars, borrowed money, by the way, on Star Wars, or when Bush spends hundreds of billions of dollars dropping bombs on Iraqis, that kind of government growth is destructive to us because it doesn't produce any positive benefit.
Well, the European Union and Japan have very similar problems with the rate of growth of their deficits. Their deficits as a proportion of their economies are just as bad as ours.
Not right across the board, but yes, in some cases, and it's because they're embracing neoliberalism. It's because ever since Thatcher and Reagan, there's been this fad all across the world among the developed countries to embrace this neoliberalism, which we call Reaganomics, conservative economic policies. Let's cut taxes on rich people. Let's cut taxes on corporations. Let's let corporations pay one off, play one off against the other. Corporations in the 1950s paid 35% of the total tax load for this country. Now it's 7%. What's wrong with that picture? You and I are paying the rest. 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
The NSA?
Don't bother me with Pfizer, of course. I haven't got the time. Well, I bend the law until it breaks. I'm so lonesome I could spy.
You could spy?
What are you doing?
Just lying here thinking about you.
I can hear you breathing.
That's not me.
Ha! That's not me. Oh, love it. Welcome back. Irish. You know, this is going to sound crazy, but it's true. The first 6 months after we started doing this show 6 years ago, on a fairly regular basis, I would hear loud breathing on my phone, and it wasn't me, and it wasn't the person I'm talking to. There it is. What can you say? 866-303-2270, your telephone number. Peggy in Los Angeles, listening at K-Talk. Hey, Peggy.
Hi. I just wanted to make the comment. I do professional genealogy, and I keep hearing these people who want to go back to basically the time of Dickens and the time of the Middle Ages and the Dark Ages.
The robber baron era, anyway.
Yeah, no, they really want to go back to having this really rich people and everybody else is really poor. Mm. What they forget is the reason that we have half of what we have right now is because the middle class had the pocketbooks to help the rich pay for innovations to happen, like in medicine. If you can't spread the cost of a lot of things over a lot of people, the rich didn't really live that well in those days. There were no improvements on things, nothing. And really, the middle class is really important to the rich, and they don't seem to get that.
Right.
Because if they go back to a two-class society, they're going to have all the bad things that you see in Dickens, which is, diseases going through because people can't care for things. A lot more theft from poverty. They don't realize that the middle class is as important to the rich in having their life be really good. And the other thing is the rich have a lot of money doesn't mean that the middle class can't have a reasonable life too. Because like I was saying, they improve the life of the rich. They work.
Right. But at a certain point, it does become a zero sum game. And not to say that it always is. I mean, obviously the system has some elasticity built into it. But what we see over time is that when you have, and certainly we've seen three large cycles of this in the history of the United States, when you have a relatively egalitarian tax system and you have a large and strong middle class, it always coincides with high taxes on the very, very rich, whether it's inheritance taxes or income taxes or both. On the other hand, when you have very low taxes on the very, very rich and you have explosions of wealth among a very small elite, you see a substantial decrease in the middle class and an increase in the working poor. And you know, you can see that all around the world. You can see that in any country. It's just, it is a, at a certain level, a zero-sum game. But Peggy, your point is absolutely right. And I think that, and thank you for the call. I think a lot of these people just think that, well, they'll just live in their gated community and everything will be fine and we'll just get armed guards to walk around the perimeter. Sorry. You know, ultimately, you know, the TB down the street doesn't care whether you've got an armed guard or not. You know, that person sneezing or spitting on the street is going to get you. Ivana in Maine. Hey, Ivana, welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you for having me. I love your program.
Thank you.
I used to live in Denmark, and I lived there since I was 18 years old. And this guest of yours, doctor, surprised me by having so little knowledge about European countries.
Mm-hmm.
Denmark maybe is not producing a lot of goods, but they do have know-how that they – that's how – how they keep being prosperous because of their know-how. And the know-how they are getting through public education.
Right, yeah, exactly. And that's a great point. And that's one of the great equalizers, and it's one of the great agents of social mobility, is that you can go all the way to a PhD, and not only is it a free education, but the government even gives you a stipend to go to college. Ivana, thank you very much for the call and your contribution to the show. Tim in Detroit, Michigan, listening on WDTW. Hey, Tim.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Recently I read in Forbes that approximately 10 million people in the world are millionaires. And that figure struck me for several reasons. Well, one is that I think with that much of a concentration in wealth, you can do a lot of damage. Not necessarily a lot of good. You can, for example, buy governments. You can, of course, spend on war. You know, a lot of these people are defense contractors or private contractors. We have a lot of intelligence now that's farmed out to private contractors. And as a result, a lot of the rich effectively become cut off from the people and make a lot of money and make a lot of policies endemic to the people. And as a result, the concentration of wealth being very pyramidal in nature is very destructive, not just to humans, but also the planet.
Yeah. And also, $1 million ain't what it used to be. I mean, the fact of the matter is that there are middle-class Americans right now who have $1 million in assets between, say, you know, $200,000-$300,000 in a house and a couple $100,000 in a 401k and whatever. They may actually, on paper, be a millionaire. One serious illness, and they're wiped out. You know,
sure.
they think that they're going to have enough money to retire on. I'm sorry, $1 million ain't what it used to be. You can rack up $1 million in hospital bills in a year or so with a serious illness, you know, with cancer, something like that. I've seen it.
But the pyramid also gets much steeper at the top too. For example, if you're a billionaire, you can withstand a lot of things.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's why, you know, you said there's 10 million millionaires in the world. I think that we really need to be looking at the number of billionaires in the world. And that's in the tens of thousands at the very most. Maybe just thousands. Yeah. And that's the real concentration of wealth. And that's where the wealth becomes pathological. That's where, you know, where it becomes, as Jefferson talked about, a threat to the free state. And that concentration of wealth, Tim, thanks for the call. That concentration of wealth is the kind of thing that John McCain wants to maintain. He thinks it's a fine thing. In fact, he'd like, well, of course, he's worth $100 million, and he has 8 houses. And for some reason, they don't think he's an elitist. Whereas Barack Obama, who just finally paid off his college loans, he's an elitist? I don't get this. Maybe Ronnie Deutsch can fill us in, who wants to talk about this. RonnieDeutsch.com. Stick around.
The Tom Hartman Program.
You are listening to Tom Hartman.
Defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Listening to Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program.
The True People's Radio.
This is Tom Hartman.
Well, if you haven't figured it out by now, that's me. 6 minutes past the hour. Welcome back to the second hour of our program. Ronnie Deutsch is with us. Ronnie Deutsch, the experienced tax attorney, founder of the nation's largest law firm dedicated to resolving IRS-backed cases, tax cases, and now the largest tax resolution law firm in the country, RONIDEUTCH.com, RonnieDeutsch.com. Hey, Ronnie.
Good morning, Tom.
Great to have you with us. You've been blogging on your blog over at RonnieDeutsch.blogspot.com about John McCain and his taxes. And, you know, when your folks originally contacted us, The message that we got was that you wanted to come on and speak on behalf of McCain's tax perspective, but it doesn't quite, from reading your blog, I'm not quite getting that. What are your thoughts on this?
Thank you so much for having me, first of all, Tom. My thoughts are pretty simple. What I like about McCain is that he does not want to come in and raise taxes. I like that, especially now when you look at the economy and look at what do we need to do and how do we stimulate the economy. What else do I like about McCain? I like the
Let's just pause here with that for a moment. So you're suggesting that oil should go to $300 a barrel, because if we don't raise taxes and we continue with a 10, 12, 14, $16 trillion debt, the value of the dollar is going to continue to drop.
Well, again, you and I are talking about oil, all right? We know we have an oil issue.
No, I'm talking about the dollar.
Okay, well, we know the dollar is going to rebound eventually, Tom. I mean, look at the cycles of our dollar. We know right now we're an all-time low, but we know post-election is always a bump on our dollar.
But how can the dollar rebound when we've got a debt right now? I mean, you know, Ronald Reagan in 8 years ran up more debt than every president from George Washington to Jimmy Carter combined. I mean, these guys over the last 30 years have borrowed more money than we used to, even in real dollars, inflation-adjusted dollars, than we used to fight the Civil War, World War I, World War II, the Spanish-American War, and the Vietnam War combined. And that's what's destroying our dollar, along with the fact that we no longer manufacture anything in the United States because of these insane trade policies. We're not generating wealth in this country. We're just saying, would you like fries with that? How can the dollar rebound?
Okay, but go on. Everybody wants fries with that, Tom. You and I know that whatever president is elected, they're going to inherit a $1 trillion deficit. We already know that, Tom.
No, a debt, not a deficit.
Okay, we know we're going to have issues with the economy. We know we do right now. What I want to focus on is how can we look at taxes to turn something around, to stimulate a little bit, Tom, and that's what I like about McCain. Hey, you like Obama's policy, but I want to just interject here that if McCain is elected, you're right. The oil people are going to make billions more dollars. Okay, I get it, Tom, but we've also got to look at the millions and millions of corporations out there that will pay less in corporate taxes. Let's look at here in America what you and I have to do. We've got to lower corporate taxes.
Why?
Obama's not going to do
why?
That.
Wait a minute, Ronnie. Corporations in the 1950s, when things were going along pretty strong, we were the largest industrial economy in the world. The United States was the world's largest creditor. We were the largest manufacturer of manufactured goods, the largest exporter of manufactured goods on Earth, in the history of the planet, in the 1950s. We had a top marginal tax rate of 91%, and corporations were paying 35% of all total federal income tax receipts. Right now, we have become the largest importer of finished goods in the world. We're the largest exporter of raw materials, which is the definition of a third world country. We are no longer the world's largest creditor. We are now the world's largest debtor after 30 years of Reaganomics and McCainomics. We have gone from being essentially a first world country to a third world country, and we're seeing the ability of people to average middle class people to actually even have a life just wiped out. How can more of that be a good thing?
But remember, we didn't have instant text messages, Tom. We didn't have a fax machine. We didn't have cell phones. Everything you're talking
telephones.
About historically, let you and I talk about today, right? Middle class Americans are going to be fine under McCain's policy.
No, but my point, Ronnie, that you're not addressing, the corporations were paying 35% of the total taxes in the United States in the 1950s. They're now paying 7% of our total taxes. We have a 35% top corporate tax rate, which is one of the higher ones in the industrialized world, but no corporations pay that tax rate. And then on top of that, you've got all these corporations like Halliburton that just say, to hell with it, we're going to reincorporate in Dubai and pay no taxes.
And again, Tom, I'm sitting here saying to you, yeah, we've got tax havens, we've got tax shelters, we've got tax loopholes, we've got special interest groups. Yes, Tom, we have a major tax crisis. You're saying, Ronnie, if McCain is elected, all the bad is going to keep on going. And I come back and say, Tom, I'm trying to simplify it and say I disagree respectfully. I truly believe that there are plenty of corporations that pay their fair share at 35%, Tom. And what about...
Name one.
Wait, what about the people getting the dividends? What about us on the other end, Tom? Obama wants to raise that to 35%.
Okay, that's a great question. So, Ronnie, you're suggesting to me that somebody who earns their living by showing up at the office should pay a top tax rate of, what is it, 35% right now, 36%?
I absolutely... absolutely believe that the wealthy should pay their fair
share. You're the tax expert. 35%. Okay, so somebody who earns their living showing up at the office, or somebody who earns their living out building roads, you know, they're out there on the highway pouring concrete or whatever, they should pay 35%. But somebody who earns their living sitting on their butt around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive in the mail, they should pay a maximum income tax rate of 15%, which is what it is right now under the Bush tax cuts. That's what you're defending?
Tom, yes, I am defending that we need...
How can you defend that?
You're asking me. Let me finish, Tom. I am defending that platform, yes, because if we as Americans, it's not just the guy digging ditches, it's everyone across the board who can afford to have those dividends, Tom. I want them to pay less in taxes so they'll keep investing, Tom. They'll keep investing. They'll have money to reinvest. What, do they want to buy a home? What do they want to do with that money? Send their kids to college? Tom, if taxes remain low, lower income, middle income, and we keep it fair for the wealthy, Tom, then we can stimulate the
economy. Let's keep it fair for the wealthy and screw the working people?
Tom, I'm not saying to screw the working people. I'm saying under...
What you're saying is that capital is more important than labor, that people who earn their living with capital should only pay a 15% income tax, and people who earn their living by labor should pay a top 35% income tax. And I don't see how you can call that fair.
But, Tom, the people that are making the money, that are investing in our economy, are the risk takers that are putting...
I'm sorry, the people who are making our economy are the workers. They're the ones who are productive. They're the ones who are producing the goods and services that drive this economy. Just because somebody had enough money to start a business doesn't mean that they're contributing to the economy. It's the people who work for them who are making the economy.
And, Tom, don't you think McCain's platform is going to benefit the lower income and the middle income?
No.
Working their butts up? It is going to benefit them, Tom. He's not raising taxes.
No, he's going to borrow from their children.
You believe they'll borrow from their children?
Well, that's what he's doing. That's what they're doing right now. You know, we've got a $10 trillion debt. That's on a credit card that my children and grandchildren are going to have to pay off. And yours, too.
Okay, but step back now.
Obama and McCain wants to continue the same thing.
Hey, but Obama wants to keep taxes low for lower income and keep taxes low for middle income. So does McCain. How do you differentiate that?
Well,
Obama's
because
saying the same thing as McCain. They're just
Obama wants to raise taxes on the very wealthy so that we can have the balanced budget. We had a balanced budget in the last 2 years of the Clinton administration. I would much rather pay a little more in taxes and have the Clinton economy than have the situation that we have right now with regard to taxes and the situation we have right now with regard to the economy. It's real
simple. Time out, Tom. I'm making a point about what you're saying. You're saying, Ronnie, look at the people that are working, Ronnie. They're the people that deserve these breaks. And I'm coming back and saying to you, Tom, with both candidates, both of the middle income and lower income are going to get their tax breaks. Where you and I differ, Tom, is on the top levels. I differ and disagree with you.
Ronnie, how can you say that average people are getting a tax break when in their names, debt is being accumulated? Right now, every working family in America owes $115,000 to the rest of the world as their share of our national debt. That's four times what it was when Ronald Reagan came into office.
Okay, what if McCain came in and did something about our tax gap, Tom? What if the guy was able to regenerate the $345 billion that's missing from the IRS? Let you and I talk.
It's a drop in the bucket.
Tom, it's a major bucket changer, though. If we get $345
billion, that's only half of just the deficit that George Bush is going to run up this year.
But time out, Tom. We could get that every year is what I'm trying to say to you. It's not a one-year pass, go get your $345 billion. If McCain goes in here and does the things he says he's going to do, Tom,
we'll be deeper in debt.
No, Tom, we got a chance of getting our $345 billion year after year from the IRS, which is going down the black hole that Obama is not addressing. Yes, of course, we've got this huge $115,000. I'm hearing what you're saying. I'm looking for the solutions, Tom, as it relates to the IRS.
Okay, people can read all about it. Ronnie, I'm sorry we're out of time, but, you know, I appreciate your coming on, and boy, you give as good as you get. I really honor that. Ronnie Deutsch, RONIDEUTCH.com is the website. Thanks, Ronnie, for being with us.
Thank you for your time. Have a great day.
Thanks, you too. 16 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman.
Speaking the truth that multinational corporations don't want you to know.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
another song down memory lane with GW, that's me, and the Carlisle Group. Here we go. They are saying that I knew and that I lied to you. But I'm not the only one hiding smoking guns. We blow smoke in your eyes.
Yeah, we're sort of noticing that, George.
Because you get news from your TV and they cover up for me. They don't ask why towers fell, because we pay them really well to blow smoke in your eyes.
Indeed. Well, thank you, George. Thank you very much. 22 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Strange things going on out there in the world. In this case, in San Francisco, the poor Republican Party. I mean, this is just sad. 10,000 signatures turned in to get on the ballot in November, renaming. Now, this is a proposal from the Presidential Memorial Commission of San Francisco. They want to switch the name of the Oceanside Water Pollution Control Plant to the George W. Bush Sewage Plant. The chairman of the San Francisco Republican Party has promised to fight the measure if it makes the ballot. But the people calling for this say it's a fitting tribute to the outgoing chief executive and the mess he'll leave behind. Brian McConnell, a member of the group that was formed after friends came up with the renaming idea, said, "We think it's important to remember our leaders in the right historical context. In President Bush's case, we think that we will be cleaning up a substantial mess for the next 10 to 20 years. The sewage treatment facility's job is to clean up a mess, so we think it's a fitting tribute. The mess, as supporters see the plan, includes the aftermath of the Iraq War, neglect of domestic economic issues, and so on." Anyhow, call by the Associated Press to White House press officials was not returned. Can you imagine the Republicans fighting to keep a sewage plant from being named the George W. Bush Memorial Sewage Plant? I love it. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number today. What a time. I mean, this is, in my opinion, the major point of cleavage between Barack Obama and John McCain. The one everyone talks about is the Iraq War, and obviously that's a huge one. It plays into the economy. But even beyond that, I think, frankly, John McCain has figured out that the Iraq War ain't all that great a thing. And in all probability, he will, well, God only knows what he'll do. You wonder sometimes. But the economy, this is an area where we're talking about fundamentally different core beliefs about how things should be. You've got John McCain, the elitist with eight mansions around the United States and, you know, over $100 million in the bank, the elitist John McCain. And you got Barack Obama, who just finally paid off his college loans. And for some reason, the corporate media in the United States wants to call him an elitist. Tell me why that is. Well, perhaps because their interests are not served so much by him as they are by John McCain. But nonetheless, we'll continue with this conversation here on the phone. Pat in Grand Rapids, Michigan, listening on WTKG. Hey, Pat, what's on your mind?
Yes. I just wanted to know if you had any idea. Every time you have one of these conservatives on that says, if you raise the taxes on the rich, they're not going to invest their money because it's not going to be worth it. What are they going to do with their money?
Right. Well, A, they will invest it, but B, it doesn't matter. Here's the thing that most people don't get. If I take, let's say that I was able to magically manufacture, let's say that I, in the backyard of my house, if I had a backyard, my backyard's actually a river. I live on the water, but I mean in the water, you know, our house floats inside. But let's say I had a backyard and I dug down and I found
you know, a big pile of gold, and all of a sudden I've got $1 million worth of gold, and I take it down and I convert it to dollars, and what am I going to do with that? I go down and I say, okay, I'm going to invest in the American economy. I buy $100,000 or $1 million, say it's $1 million worth of gold, I buy $1 million worth of stock. You know, whether it's ExxonMobil or Apple or IBM, it doesn't matter, I buy $1 million worth of stock. What does that do? All that does is I didn't put $1 million into ExxonMobil or IBM or General Motors by doing that. I simply put $1 million into the pockets of some other stockholder who decided to sell his stock. And if he sold it at a profit, by the way, he's only going to pay a maximum of 15% income because it's a capital gain. And you know, if he lost money, he can deduct it from his income taxes. You know, try doing that with the loss of, you know, the barbecue set that you bought or something like that. I mean, this is where it is so skewed. People investing in the stock market are not stimulating our economy. And people just don't get it. You know, Pat, thank you for your call. This is such a core concept. When a business starts, the initial investors who put in the money, they're the ones who fund that business. Beyond that, when you buy stock in a company, you're not giving a penny to that company. You're not supporting ExxonMobil if you buy ExxonMobil stock, unless you can buy enough of it to drive up the value of the stock so that the executives can sell off their stock options. But the money is not going to ExxonMobil. It's going to some other stockholder. Once that stock has been issued and it's out in the market, it's simply a game. It's simply going around in a circle. So to say, well, we've got to make sure that the wealthy have more wealth so that they can invest it, it's not helping the rest of us.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Give us a call at
Gin out on the great high plains. It's done closed down along with the school and the hospital and the swimming pool. Dust devils dance in the noonday heat. There's rats in the alley and trash in the street. Gang graffiti on a boxcar door. We can't make it here anymore.
Tragically, increasingly, that's how it is. Back 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 866-303-2270, our number, tomhartman.com. If you want to drop in, and airamerica.com, drop into our live chat room or participate in the blog or our message board. Let's see here. Ken in Cypress, California. Hey, Ken, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. I know you're doing great. I'm a little perturbed. You were talking to Ronnie, and my concern with you know, though I appreciate hearing the other side, Ronnie's just too young to have a conversation with.
What?
She just doesn't understand history, and if she was to go back and study history instead of economics, she would understand that she, you know, needs to learn a little bit more and maybe talk to some older economics professors instead of thinking she's this, the end-all and do-all and
okay.
Be-all of everything.
Well, you know, Ken, you know, your sentiments are appreciated, but, you know, Ronnie's not here to defend herself, and she actually, you know, she's a lawyer, a tax lawyer, and runs one of the more substantial tax firms in the country. She's not a kid, and we'll just leave it at that. Rex in Castro Valley. Hey, Rex.
Hello, Mr. Hartman?
Yes, sir.
Yes, compliment you on the program. You all are saying exactly whatever needs to be said. But I'm just saying that there's only one time in history when the sovereignty of the public sector became a reality, and that was during the Roosevelt administration during the Depression years.
Mm-hmm.
But since the Second World War, the private sector has become almost sovereign over the public sector.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the rolling back of the New Deal. I mean, that's what it has always been about through this whole thing, is rolling back the New Deal, undoing the New Deal. And it's an absolute tragedy that the whole goal ever since, I mean, you know, actually it was happening during the New Deal, was to undo the New Deal. I mean, it started, but it really started with Taft-Hartley in 47 when the Republicans got control of the House and Senate, and when they shot down Truman's attempt to have a national health insurance program. And there's been a steady attack on the public sector ever since.
Yes. Yeah. And that's what I'm a little worried about, Senator Obama, because he's not, he doesn't seem to be saying much about that situation.
Well, we'll see. I think the jury is out for the moment, but, I can tell you, Rex, one thing, Senator Obama is one hell of a lot better than John McCain on virtually all of these issues. This is the bottom line, though, from the right's point of view.
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
That's really the bottom line. So, John in Scottsdale, Arizona. Hey, John.
Yeah, hi. Great show. I wanted to talk about tax dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to talk about the hypocrisy it's given when by conservatives or whoever, when tax dollars are paid by average Americans, and they have a right to expect the health services and education in return. And I wanted to talk about defense. And I'd like to put aside the military expenditures. I'll even put aside Blackwater. And I want to look at for a moment the billions of dollars in waste associated with the reconstruction of Iraq. And as a result, nothing comes, virtually small amounts come back to the United States, but billions in oil revenue are given over to the big oil. Mm-hmm. And what do Americans get? We get higher gas prices at the pump, and that means, to me, higher taxes, because we pay taxes on a percentage basis.
Well, and not only that, I don't have the statistics over the last 15 years. I haven't been able to find them anyway. But
right.
At the end of the 1980s, in 1989, we imported about $10 billion worth of oil from the Middle East.
Absolutely.
We spent about $30 billion protecting those oil supplies. For every dollar we spent at the pump, we spent $3 in taxes for the military that defended that oil. And that does not show up as cost of oil.
Can I make a very quick point?
Sure.
It has nothing to do with the taxes, but it has to do with FISA. You see, when they get into those records, they not only look at candidates, they look at the contributors. And once they get their contributors, they can find dirt on your contributor if you're running for election. And so the intimidation not only goes to the candidate, it goes all the way down the line.
So you're back to my theory yesterday that perhaps the Bush administration has been spying on these guys, particularly since an interesting point, John, particularly since the media keeps saying and the politicians keep saying Bush started spying on us after 9/11. But the testimony and the record, the testimony of the head of Quest, the one company that said, no, we won't do it, is that Bush approached them in February of 2001. That is within a month after he was appointed to the Supreme Court, to the presidency by the Supreme Court, and said, I want to spy on people illegally. Will you go along with it? And all the other telephone companies said yes, and Quest said no. And none of their other CEOs, and I think you can probably find any of these huge companies that you can dig up some dirt on, none of their other CEOs ended up in prison, and the head of Quests did. But in any case, it was February of 2001 that Bush started spying. I would love to see Barack Obama or any other senator get up on the floor of the Senate when this FISA debate comes up, in all probability today or tomorrow, and say, okay, we will give telecom immunity. I mean, obviously, it's going to pass. We're going to do it. But only for those decisions that were made after 9/11. Because that's how it's all being justified. And all of a sudden, you'd see Republicans scurrying for cover like, you know, cockroaches when the light's been turned on. Keith in Pasadena, California. Hey, Keith.
Howdy, Tom. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I'm a tax professional here. I've been working 20 years here in the area, and I wanted to take your back on a few of the things that you were basically saying. The fun and games in terms of the capital tax rules and laws are exactly that. It's a lot of fun and games. the individuals who are actually claiming those, and it's the wealthy. I mean, we're all partially in them in our retirement funds and everything.
Right. Now Keith, let me just pause you for a second for our listeners who may have just tuned in or who don't know what we're talking about. There are two kinds of taxation in the United States right now as a result of the Bush tax policies. It goes back to Reagan tax policies. If you earn your living showing up at an office or, you know, out there, you know, building roads or bridges or something, if you earn your living by the sweat of your brow or the sweat of your muscles, you pay a maximum 35% income tax rate. If you earn your living sitting on your butt around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive or a capital gains check to arrive, you pay a maximum 15% income tax. And after $98,000, I think it is, no matter how you earn your income, you pay absolutely no FICA or Social Security taxes. And the conservatives defend this as saying, well, people who are earning their money, from capital, they're somehow superior to those of us who work.
Yep, that's, you've said it all. The fun and games is that they're not necessarily all paying up to the 15%. Remember.
Right, because that's graduated.
Yeah, it's graduated going up. And also, the government does not know what the basis in terms of any of these stocks are. So it's stock reporting on tax returns is the biggest honors program that the federal government runs.
Oh, really?
Because you're allowed to use 9 different methods in terms of figuring out exactly what it is. LIFO, last in, first out, FIFO, actual, averaging over 2 different periods of time. You don't actually have to put down exactly what you've paid for those particular stocks. So by using those numbers and manipulating exactly when you've bought the stocks, when you're selling them, you do not have to pay as much in terms of the taxes. So they're not even paying, in a lot of cases, all the way up to the 15%.
Yeah, I'm in the wrong business.
Now, interestingly enough, Bill Clinton, back with the previous administration, basically, you know, there's an advantage for growing up poor because he understood the difference between tax credits and tax reduction.
Right.
If you are in the 15% bracket and you get a $1,000 tax break, that's only going to translate to $150 into your pocket. When Bill Clinton was in, he basically put tax credits into place, and most of the stuff that's on the second page of the tax return. So educational credits, residential energy credits. Education is the best example. You pay $1,000 in for school, you get $1,000 back in terms of tax.
Right. It's not a deduction. It's an actual dollar-for-dollar amount.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, under this administration, we've had tax tax breaks in terms of the rates. But again, just as you said earlier, most of those have been for the extremely wealthy. And none of them were complaining about how high the taxes were during the Clinton administration. In fact, they were doing extremely well under that. And there was, there was a little bit of conversation about possibly the conservatives backing Hillary Clinton simply because they wanted to bring back the times when they were doing much better.
Right.
So, it's very, very funny how the system works.
Yeah, well said, Keith. Thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. And you know, it's one of the Clinton themes or campaigns, well, could have been and should have been and probably was at various times, you know, I'd be glad to pay the Clinton taxes if I had the Clinton economy. And, for that matter, I'd pay the Eisenhower taxes for the Eisenhower economy. And the Eisenhower taxes were 91%.
Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Oh, what an excellent point. Well, friend Shelley Drobny, who was the guy who started Air America Radio, actually, and is also worked for the IRS for years and years and years and is a tax expert as well as a venture capitalist, just sent me a note. He says, you want me to chime in on this? He says, historically, when individual taxes were higher on the wealthy,
again, as I said, you know, give me the Eisenhower taxes of 91%, the Kennedy taxes of 71%. He says, historically, when individual taxes were higher on the wealthy, the economy is stimulated because the lower income people pay less tax and have more spendable income. See, that's the bottom line, is that what drives an economy is consumer spending. And so if you reduce the taxes, which is what Barack Obama is proposing to do, by the way, reduce or minimize the taxes to working people, then they will spend that money. Spending money, frankly, is much better for the economy than so-called investing money, you know, buying stocks in the stock market. Buying stock in the stock market is simply moving money around from the hands of one investor to another investor. As I pointed out, the money does not end up in the corporation's pocket. It doesn't help the corporation. Eric in Southbridge, Massachusetts, and listening to WHMP. Hey, Eric, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, hi. I'm an internet listener, and I listen to your show almost every day. I have a solution to the big monetary crisis that we're facing, and also I'd like to call attention to a crisis that no one has mentioned yet, and that is the obsolescence of the Lincoln penny next year. It was started in 1909, and 2009 gives us the opportunity to put George Bush's portrait on it. And a selection, and a rotating selection of his most idiotic pronouncements on the back. Now, the advantage of this plan is that, first of all, people wouldn't spend this penny; they'd buy them by the gross to collect them.
Right.
And
well, there's a problem with that, though, Eric, because right now there's more than a penny's worth of copper at a penny.
Well, then we'll make it out of our basest, most worthless. Metal. Maybe yeah. The people at the San Francisco water treatment plant can come up with some sludge or something we can make them out of.
There you go.
But the point is, no, this is such a brilliant thing, because if we did this, 10,000 years from now, people would be digging these out of the ground saying, now there was an idiot.
Yeah, well said. Eric, thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Ellen Ratner is with us with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., Talk Radio News, although Ellen, you're in, where are you, in Dubai today?
I am in Dubai.
And what's the news in the world?
Well, first of all, Pfizer was going to come up, as you know, on a vote, mm-hmm. but they're attending Jesse Helms' funeral today, so there's a reprieve.
Another one-day reprieve. There's a disconnect here, and I would love it if any of your reporters would be able to ask somebody about this in a way that could get it into the public. The story when the head of Verizon was prosecuted, the story that was in the New York Times, I don't have it in front of me, I had it yesterday, was that he asserted under oath that he was approached in February of 2001, in other words, a month after George Bush became president, to spy on people illegally outside of FISA. All of the Republicans are running around saying, and Democrats for that matter, who support, you know, giving telco immunity, say this was a post 9/11, you know, activity. What if a senator were to stand up and say, okay, you guys want immunity, we'll give you immunity for everything you did after 9/11. We can understand the national hysteria, but anything you did before 9/11, no immunity. Because apparently all of this actually started a month after Bush came into office.
Yeah, I just I saw that as well, and I got to tell you, it's shocking. Mm-hmm. But I also know that not in terms of FISA and telecoms, but in terms of national identity cards and that stuff, mm-hmm. the Clinton administration actually tried it, and they had it back down on it. But in private sure. meetings, they were trying to pull that one off.
Yeah. So I know a lot of this stuff is nothing new, and the executive branch grasping for more power is something that goes all the way back to the Adams administration. But nonetheless, we do need to be pushing back. Anyhow, so the FISA bill has been postponed for a day?
For a day, for the Helms funeral. Okay. Now, I'm sure that you have been focusing on talking about the Iraq issue and the fact that we talked yesterday about the status of forces agreement and the fact that when al-Maliki was in Iraq, I mean, when it was in UAE in Abu Dhabi, that he was pretty clear. Well, he even said things that are not being reported in the U.S. news, at least not where I have seen. And one of the things that he said is, this means the phenomena of unilateral detention will be over, as well as unilateral operations and immunity. He didn't go into detail, but I think that's about as clear as day. And now Iraq's security advisor, I believe he was in Karbala today talking to reporters, and he also has insisted on troop withdrawal.
So,
and what's so fascinating about this is you had Brian Whitman saying, well, at the Pentagon, you know, we want to see what happens on the ground. You know, these things tend to be fluid. One of the people at the State Department saying, well, maybe they got the transcript wrong. I mean, he also said very clearly, today we are looking at the necessity of terminating the foreign presence on Iraqi lands and restoring full sovereignty. What else do you need to say?
Right. This is a complete repudiation of Bush and the Bush doctrine and the McCain doctrine, for that matter.
Exactly.
But it's
not going anywhere.
Right, and it's not, and it's by and large not being reported in the United States or not even being seriously discussed. It really is pretty astounding. It really is.
So, so that's what's happening on that front. Also, it's interesting that the United States just shifted their carrier, the Abraham Lincoln, from the Persian Gulf to the Gulf of Oman. Now, they're saying that it's going to support operations in Afghanistan.
Interesting.
Maybe.
Interesting. Well, Afghanistan seems to be falling apart, so that makes a certain amount of sense, although it could
Absolutely.
Be in Pakistan, too. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, Talk Radio News. Thanks, Ellen.
Thank you.
Don Siegelman coming up next.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Listening to Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program.
On Common Sense from the Radical Middle.
This is Tom Hartman.
For some reason, they feel compelled to say it three times. Welcome back. Oh, my. In addition to the economic shenanigans, the weirdnesses, all the tax stuff, which we will get back to at some length, and also I want to get into what happened to the G8 summit today. Some bizarre things there. The Karl Rove case, this criminal, Karl Rove, well, I guess I can't quite call him that because he has not yet been convicted of anything, but this man of questionable character, Karl Rove, has said that he is not going to testify in the case of the very selective prosecution, in the opinion of many, of Don Siegelman. And Don Siegelman has been on the former governor of Alabama has been on our program a number of times. I encourage you to go to his website, donsiegelman.org or .com. It's Siegelman is I before E, like they taught you in school, Don, SIEGELMAN.org or .com. And you can help him out with his cause and get the latest news. And I'm just very, very pleased to have him back with us. Don Siegelman, welcome to the program.
Tom, you had it right the first time. You described him as a criminal, and he's not a man of questionable character. He doesn't have character. This is a guy who on this Thursday at 10 o'clock in the morning has been subpoenaed by the United States Congress to appear and answer questions about selective prosecution. And my bet is he is going to spit in the face of Congress. He is not going to show up. He's going to disregard Congress's constitutional powers to subpoena witnesses. And as Americans, we should not tolerate it.
Right.
This man needs to be brought. He is not above the law, and he needs to be brought before the United States Congress and put in a chair and made to. If he doesn't want to swear to tell the truth, then let him, not put his hand on a Bible. And if he refuses to answer questions, let him take the Fifth Amendment. But he has an obligation to appear.
Yeah, they should do it like Bobby Kennedy did with the mob. I mean, it's. But here's the question, Governor. Last week we were hearing from a couple of members of the committee that they were going to use contempt or perhaps even inherent contempt, which is where the House actually sends its own police force out to arrest somebody in the jail that they have in the basement of the Capitol, if Mukasey, the Attorney General, refuses to do so, and odds are he would. And now I'm getting all these emails and hearing kind of back-channel stories, and I wanted to get, you know, you really have your finger on the pulse of this, that Nancy Pelosi's office, now this is, I have no idea if this is true or not, that Nancy Pelosi's office has asked the chairman, Conyers and others, not to use inherent contempt and not to try to prosecute Karl Rove for contempt of Congress if he refuses to testify. Is that true, or is this just one of these hysterical rumors that's running around?
Well, I hope it's not true. I have no idea. I have not heard anything about that one way or the other, but I do know that there is going to be a reluctance to hold Karl Rove in contempt. I mean, they had trouble just getting the contempt citations voted on against Joshua Bolton and Harriet Myers. And, you know, I think there's some reluctance on the part of Democrats because they don't want to appear, quote, political right, you know, before the election. But this is not about politics. This is about upholding our Constitution and restoring justice and preserving our democracy. And somebody's got to tell Congress that they're the only ones who can stand up and do this, and they have to stand up to this man, Karl Rove.
Yeah.
They cannot sit back and allow him to thumb his nose at the United States Congress.
Right. This is a very important time for every one of us to call to call both our members of Congress, our individual members of Congress, because there is, to some extent, peer pressure here, but in particular to call members of, it's the House Judiciary Committee that's doing this, right?
It's the House Judiciary Committee, which has been leading the charge, and there's some great heroes on that committee.
Right.
And I think John Conyers is one of them.
Right.
But we need to shore up the committee and then shore up the United States Congress and tell them to, you know, if they don't have any backbone, then grow some, you know, and
yeah.
Let's get, you know what I'm talking about. They've got to stand up to this guy. You know, this is going to, Karl Rove's involvement in subverting our Constitution and turning the Department of Justice into a political tool is going to make Watergate, which he also participated in, is going to make Watergate look like child's play. You know, and we have had people from Republicans, like former United States Attorney General Richard Thornburgh, who has looked at what is going on, and he said, this smells like politics.
Yeah.
It looks like selective prosecution. We've had the former Republican Attorney General from Arizona, who was interviewed by 60 Minutes, who said that, in my case, he said they couldn't beat Sigelman fair and square, so they targeted him.
Right.
And we've got Republicans who are standing up and saying that what, in essence, what Karl Rove has been alleged to have done and has been, and there's sworn testimony from a Republican lawyer that places Rove at the scene of the crime.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we need some of our good Democrat congressmen now to stand up and have the same internal fortitude that these Republicans are
right.
having.
And wouldn't it be nice if some of the Republicans actually decided that the rule of law was important, too? If you go to judiciary.house.gov, that's the website for the House Judiciary Committee, judiciary.house.gov. And there is a complete list of the Judiciary Committee membership, and many of them are in areas where we're on the air right now, where we're being heard. Berman in California, Boucher in Virginia, Nadler in New York, Scott in Virginia, Watt in North Carolina, Lofgren in California, Jackson Lee in Texas, Waters in California, Delahunt in Massachusetts, Wexler in Florida, Sanchez in California, Cohen in Tennessee, Johnson in Georgia. If you hear your member of Congress here, call them now. Sutton in Ohio, Gutierrez in Illinois, Sherman in California, Baldwin in Wisconsin, Weiner, I believe it is, in New York, Schiff in California, Davis in Alabama, Wasserman Schultz in Florida, and Ellison, Keith Ellison in Minnesota. Those are just the Democrats. And then, you know, there are the Republicans. I don't know if any of these Republicans can be influenced, but it's worth calling them as well. You can get it at judiciary.house.gov. You can get all the information about it over at donsiegelman.com as well. What beyond calling our members of Congress and calling the members of the House Judiciary Committee and saying,
please hold Karl Rove in contempt of Congress. Use inherent contempt if necessary in order to get some action immediately on this. John Conyers as well. I didn't mention his name. He's the chairman of the committee. What else can be done, Governor?
Well, you know, the fact of the matter is that there is evidence that Karl Rove has hijacked the Department of Justice and used it as a political tool. He has put his clones in power in a number of different jurisdictions. We've heard this from David Iglesias and other U.S. attorneys who were fired because they refused to prosecute Democrats in the heat of an election. In my case, you know, Karl Rove's friends and political associates, the U.S. attorney and his client, brought charges against me during the campaign, and I was brought to trial 1 month before the election. The 11th Circuit is now, I spent 9 months in federal prison. I was released by the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. 54 former attorneys general from around the country, 54 both Republicans and Democrats, so the top lawyers in the country, said that something was wrong with my case, that the judge charged the jury incorrectly, that what I did was not a crime. But what I'm saying is what we've got to do, in essence, is we've got to vote in this November election. And, you know, I'm not telling people how to vote or suggesting it, but maybe I am suggesting it. We've got to have a change in this country, and we've got to change the leadership at the Department of Justice, and we've got to replace some of these U.S. attorneys around the United States who were put into power by Karl Rove to do his political bidding.
Right. Yeah, and that in and of itself is a crime. I mean, I'd say if nothing else, it's a violation of the Hatch Act. So, contact the bottom line here. Go to donsiegelman.com for more information there about what Governor Siegelman has been going through and what can be done. And contact the members of the House Judiciary Committee, judiciary.house.gov, and call your member of Congress. You can call them all toll free, by the way, at callcongress.org. There's a list of phone numbers. Governor Don Siegelman, you're one of my heroes, sir. You've gone through hell and come back, and you're fighting the good fight. Please keep it up.
We've got to keep fighting. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Governor Don Siegelman, his website, D-O-N, Don Siegelman, S-I-E-G-E-L-M-A-N, I before E, just like in school, donsiegelman.com or .org. We'll get you there, and you can see what's going on there. And judiciary.house.gov. Make that phone call now. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Truth in Broadcasting.
Past the hour. Okay, here, if you go over to judiciary.house.gov, there is a news center there where they publish the news releases from the House Judiciary Committee. And a tip of the hat, by the way, in our chat room to, I think it was Shroomdike who passed this along. Yep, or Shroomduke, excuse me. And here's the press release. This is from the 3rd of July. For media release, July 3rd, 2008, Washington, D.C., House Judiciary Committee Chairman John Conyers, Jr., Democrat of Michigan, and Subcommittee Chairwoman Linda Sanchez, Democrat of California, responded today to Karl Rove attorney Robert Luskin's letter advising the committee that Rove would not appear before the Commercial and Administrative Law Subcommittee in violation of the committee's subpoena. In his letter received yesterday, Luskin reiterated his offer to make Rove available for an off-the-record interview without an oath about the Siegelman matter only, although the committee has made clear the need to explore with Rove related issues concerning the politicization of the Justice Department as well as the U.S. attorney firings at any hearing or interview. And now here's the quote from Sanchez and Conyers from their letter. Quote, "We want to make clear that the subcommittee will convene as scheduled and expects Mr. Rove to appear and that a refusal to appear in violation of the subpoena could subject Mr. Rove to contempt proceedings, including statutory contempt under federal law and proceedings under the inherent contempt authority of the United States House of Representatives. Now, inherent contempt, there's a real huge difference here between contempt and inherent contempt, and it's one people need to understand. If the House of Representatives, or the Senate for that matter, find somebody in contempt of Congress, then what they do is they hand off, then they ask the Justice Department, which is not a branch of the legislative, it's not part of the legislative branch of government. Keep in mind, we have three branches of government. The legislative, which is the House and Senate. The judiciary, which is everything from the Supreme Court down to your local court system. And the executive, which is the president and all of the cabinet offices under the president, which includes the Department of Defense, the Department of Health and Human Services, Education, blah, 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 through the whole list, including the Department of Justice, the Department of State. All of this falls under the executive branch. So the executive branch is, while Congress makes the laws about what's against the law and what is lawful, the executive branch is given the authority or the responsibility, actually, to carry out those laws, to execute those laws. In other words, to prosecute people, to put people in jail, to make sure that the law is followed. And the Justice Department is responsible for doing that. The head of the Justice Department right now, Michael Mukasey, the Attorney General. So under regular contempt proceedings, Congress would say, okay, this person is breaking the law. We passed a law that says that this person, Karl Rove, has to come before us and testify. He is ignoring us. He is in contempt of Congress. And this is what has happened already with subpoenas that have been issued for Josh Bolton and Harriet Myers. They've said, would you please appear? Not would you please. You are ordered to appear before Congress and testify under oath. And Bolton and Myers have said, no, we're not going to show up. And so what Congress did is held them in contempt. They said, okay, you're in contempt of Congress. Now, being in contempt of Congress means you can go to prison. But somebody has to prosecute you first. So Congress handed off to Michael Mukasey, the Justice Department, the Attorney General, and said, okay, would you please arrest Myers and Bolton and present them to Congress to testify or hold them in jail until they are willing to or prosecute them for being unwilling to? And Mukasey simply said, no, I won't do it. The executive branch define the legislative branch. Now, it hasn't been used since the 1930s, but the legislative branch also has a power called inherent contempt. There's a jail cell, a couple of them actually, in the basement of the Capitol building where the House and the Senate meet. It hasn't been used since the 1930s. The Capitol, the legislative branch, does have a police force. It's called the Capitol Police. And it's a very small police force, but it's a police force. And under inherent contempt, the House of Representatives, John Conyers, well, I assume that it would have to go through Nancy Pelosi's office as the Speaker of the House, although I don't know for sure. But the House of Representatives or the Senate can decide that they're going to personally arrest somebody. So they would send their police down to Texas or to New York if Karl Rove's on Fox News or wherever he happens to be and handcuff him and take him back to Washington, D.C. and stick him in the jail cell in the basement of Congress. This is legal. This has been done many times in the history of this country. It hasn't been done since the 1930s. Now is the time to do it again because Mukasey is refusing to prosecute these things. And Congress is only going to do this, what is considered a radical action, if they get support from you and me. So we need to be contacting our members of Congress and saying, use contempt and inherent contempt. Because what's happening with the contempt is because Mukasey is refusing to prosecute this thing, it's just going to roll over to the next Congress. And then it won't even be a standing contempt citation any longer. It'll have to be re-referred and re-prosecuted. And by that time, you'll have a new president, hopefully President Obama, and he'll be on to new agendas. Hopefully one of those agendas will be prosecuting the malefactors from this criminal administration. But let's get the job done now. Call Congress.org. You can get the toll-free numbers.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Give us a call at 866-303-2270.
is gone. Move along, move along, just to make it through. When all you gotta keep is strong. Move along, move along, like I know you do. And even when your hope is gone.
Oh, it covered so much today. But I think that the core, the key thing, the most important thing is rolling back this insane meme, this insane thought virus that the conservatives have been promoting hysterically and aggressively, that somehow if you raise taxes on rich people or corporations, that will stop investment. And actually the reverse is true. A tip of the hat to Matthew Page, the actor who sent me a note. He says, Tom, I like how you talk about Eisenhower and the tax rate was 90% after $3.2 million, and we did just fine. Just wonder why you don't go one step further and explain why we did so well. The money a business owner makes as personal income is not personal income until it's taken out of the business for personal use. When the tax rate was like it was under Eisenhower, the incentive was to not take the money out of the business, but to reinvest the money into the business. Can you imagine how much we could achieve if the billion-dollar CEO salaries were put into research and development as was done under Eisenhower? The amount of jobs that could be created, the advancement in technology available to consumers? We'd be creating a lot more good-paying jobs that would vastly outnumber anything under the current administration of McCain plan. We would start to prosper as a nation, and the trade deficit would eventually start to be reduced. In short, high taxes on income encourages reinvestment of money made far more than tax breaks for the rich, because money is not taken out of businesses for personal use, but is reinvested. That is such a nice, tight summary, Matthew. Brilliant. Thank you very much for that. And just very, very well said. 866-303-2270, your telephone number. Lorraine in Dallas, Texas. Hey, Lorraine, what's up?
Yes, Tom. I called Sheila Jackson's office just a moment ago, and the girl that answered the phone was very sweet and young-sounding, and she didn't have any idea what I was talking about. She asked me twice for the name of Karl Rove, and I finally said to her, well, do you know who Karl Rove is?
Right.
And she said, you know, she was equivocating, and I told her what I wanted to tell her, and I said, I hope that, you know, this will get through to somebody.
Right.
I think it's important. And
odds are, well, Lorraine, I understand you were disappointed in the response, but keep in mind the people who are answering the phones in a lot of these offices, particularly if you're calling the local offices, it may be an intern, it may be a part-time person, it might be somebody relatively new. Their job isn't to be policy experts. Their job is to pass, you know, to take the message and pass it along. And that's why it's so important when you call to boil your message down to basically one nice, tight, clean sentence that you can convey that they can write down and pass along. It's when people call up members of Congress's offices and try to give them paragraphs that they just, you know, it just goes tilt. It goes into the basket.
Well, I did call 202, and I was concise. I had just one other
Good.
Thing. Tom, Good. I'm 83 years old, and I have lived through every economic crisis we've ever had, and this has been the worst. I thank you for your knowledge to tell me that it's the worst, even though I know it.
You know it. Thank you,
Lorraine. Oh, yes. Thanks very much, Tom.
Thank you. Thank you so much for listening and for calling, Lorraine, and for being a patriotic American. I mean, that's the true measure. You want to know the true measure of patriotism? It's not wearing a flag pin, or it's not, you know, saying, yes, I support the troops. It's calling your member of Congress. It's showing up at a political party meeting. It's showing up at a rally. It's forwarding that email to people. It's participating in the process. Very straightforward. Scott in Miami, Florida. Hey, Scott.
How you doing? How are you?
Just great. Just great. But I'll get better. What's up?
Well, with respect to the indictment, or not the indictment, but the subpoena sent to Karl Rove.
Yeah.
The thing that bothers me the most is that the Congress, the democratically controlled House, should not need to have the population cover its back on this. They should have enough spine to do what they're supposed to do to protect the institution.
I agree.
If they don't have the spine and the intestinal fortitude to to do what's required to just keep the House of Representatives from looking like a laughingstock because they won't enforce their own rules, then nobody's going to bother to come up for their subpoenas or do anything. Everybody will thumb their nose at it.
No, I agree. But, Scott, the important point here is twofold. Number one, from Nancy Pelosi's point of view, and I know I end up half the time I'm criticizing her and half the time I'm defending her, and I am a little schizophrenic about this, but, you know, I'll just leave it at that. She has a majority in the House that's a little over 30 seats, but there are a little over 40 Democratic members of the House of Representatives who represent districts that are reliably Republican districts. And so she's got a lot of Democrats who really can't vote as if they're Democrats a lot of the time, or don't, you know, whatever. I mean, you know, Democrats in name only, and that's just a political reality, number one. But number two, and perhaps the most important thing, is that we don't elect leaders in this country. And so we shouldn't be surprised when they fail to display leadership. We elect representatives, which means that the responsibility is on us as much as it is on them to make sure that they know what we want so that they can appropriately represent us. The word leadership exists nowhere in the Constitution. You won't even find it in the Federalist Papers. The idea of leadership was something that to the founders of this country was, by and large, other than to a few of the conservatives like Thomas Paine, John Adams, was anathema. They wanted a representative form of government, and these are our representatives, and that's why we need to be letting them know what we think. So, Scott, I appreciate your point, and I absolutely agree with it, and we need to be calling them, and we need to be telling them what we have to say and you know, move on with that. Mark in San Francisco, listening on Green 960. Hey, Mark.
Hi, Tom. What I want to talk about is McCain's threatening to wipe out all the government-funded programs like Social Security and Medicaid to balance the budget.
Right.
Have you heard that? So,
well, he won't come out and say that, but you know, he says he's going to balance the budget in 4 years, and that's about the only way that he's going to do it.
And the Republicans have wanted to wipe out the New Deal with Bush wanted to, and he's just going to continue that agenda.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, here's Limbaugh as succinct as he gets. You know,
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
I mean, that is the bottom line, and that's what they're all about. They've been trying to undo the New Deal. Well, even when the New Deal was the New Deal, they called it communism. They were all hysterical about it. It is time to push back and push back big time, and we need to call. You need to be calling Congress. Sean in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Sean.
Hey, Tom. I just called Congress, and I got their comment line, and I told them that I want Karl Rove brought in on inherent contempt charges, and there should be no bargaining, and the rule of law has to be preserved. Either
yeah.
Republican or Democrat, the law must be enforced.
Very well said. You called your member of Congress, would that be Jim McDermott or Jay Inslee?
No, it's actually one of these.
You called a member of the committee?
No, I called the committee hotline.
Oh, okay. The Judiciary Committee has a special phone number just for the committee.
Yeah, they have a comment line.
Oh, interesting. At judiciary.house.gov. I didn't see that. Okay, good.
Well, I called the House operator and she gave me that phone number.
You may want to also call John Conyers' phone office and let him know.
I told him about it before. I called Pelosi's office.
Yeah.
These people are letting us down. They're not preserving the rule of law. That's the problem.
Yeah. Sean, absolutely and very well said. And they won't unless we push them to. That's the bottom line. Jim and Flint, you have thoughts on why Congress hasn't used inherent contempt? Jim?
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hey.
A couple of quick things on inherent contempt. You stated that Congress hasn't used inherent contempt since the 1930s, and that dates back to the time where there, I believe it was through an executive order, that Congress agreed with the executive that in the future all subpoenas would be enforced through the U.S. Justice Department.
Right. They cut a deal, basically, with the Justice Department. But, see, the Bush administration has reneged on that deal.
Absolutely. And that's the point, I guess, that I want everyone to know, is that it wasn't simply, you know, by custom. It was done specifically and intentionally, and that's why the House police force has been substantially reduced.
Right.
The other thing I wanted to mention was on Ronnie Deutsch. I have been a tax attorney for more than 30 years. And one of the things that she mentioned, and just in passing, that McCain wants to do apparently is to set loose the IRS to go after the so-called underground economy and to collect $300 or $400 billion that people are not paying in taxes.
Right. Let's tax money on prostitution and drugs, for example.
Well, sure.
And on the kid next door who waters your lawn or washes your car.
Well, there are two specific answers to what I believe she was implying, at least. And one is that Congress has known, and every president has known, of the existence of this underground economy for decades, and has, instead of actually going after it, has in fact hobbled the IRS through refusing to provide necessary funding to upgrade their computers and so forth. Number two, the real problem with all of that has to do with the fact that there are no, let me rephrase it this way, IRS has specifically and intentionally within the last year made a policy decision that unless a corporation owes many, many millions of dollars in tax, they're not going to go after them. But with individual taxpayers, we have programs that Congress has put in place that, for example, somebody who has the earned income credit and wrongly takes it, they're barred from ever taking it for the next 10 years.
Wow.
So,
yeah.
Again,
so it's a go after this.
And letting the big corporations run free.
Right, yeah. It's
so
the old song.
It's Jim, the smoke screen, Tom. It's
yeah,
the
Jim, screen. Jim, well said. The other point I would add to that, and thanks, that was well said, is that the only way to really get rid of the underground economy is to do away with cash. And that's going to be a real problem.
The Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Before the hour. Well, it looks like Sasha Cohen is out there and at it again.
Did it take off your coat?
Our full Monty alert for the day.
Real slow.
Crowds in Arkansas came for the lure of cage fighting and $1 beer.
Did it take off your shoe?
You got a lot of good old boys down there looking to see a cage fight. Cheap beer. And an elaborate array of mounted and handheld video cameras caught the crowd of 1600's reaction as the two men ripped off each other's clothes and started kissing each other. Went right up to the line of the city's morality laws, Harlan said. The two men stripped down to their underwear, kissed and rubbed on each other. The audience, as well as local fighters drawn to take part in the show, became enraged. It set the crowd off throwing beers, Holland said. They had beers in plastic cups. Those things can get some distance on them, actually. It took about 45 minutes to clear the convention center as the two actors sprinted away through a specially set-aside tunnel. It looks like Barat is... if the cage match visits came from Barat Cohen, it wouldn't be the first time Arkansans fell for a practical joke in 2000. Then Governor Mike Huckabee fell for a prank and conflated Canada... congratulated Canada for preserving its icebound parliament, calling it a national igloo. Yeah. So I see a new movie in the works here. We'll see how it all shakes out. 1-866-303-2270. David, you want to tell me how wonderful John McCain's economics are? David? In San Luis Obispo? David? I guess not. Let's see, Gene in San Francisco, listening on Green 960. Hey, Green, Gene.
Hi, Tom. You were talking with Governor Siegelman about the Karl Rove contempt, and the thing that sticks in my craw is that Mukasey refused to draw up those charges or whatever they are, the paperwork.
Right. He should be impeached.
That's what I was going to say. And I don't understand why simultaneously they're not impeaching him and going for that in here.
They're not impeaching him for the same reason that they're not impeaching Bush, because the Democrats all seem to think that if they keep their heads down and they be nice, that everybody will be nice, and that you know, politically it'll be a good thing for them. I'm telling you, the Democratic Party and apparently Barack Obama as well are listening to the same insane, tired out, doesn't work, kills a party, Bob Shrum type DLC advice that John Kerry got, that Al Gore got, that Michael Dukakis got, that all of them got from these guys, and it is wrong. They absolutely should be taking names and kicking ass the same way that Newt Gingrich did, the same way that Trent Lott did. They should take a lesson from these guys who actually got something done.
What they're going to do is earn what the last caller said was about, you know, nobody ever doing anything, responding to them. But what is happening is that our country is being run by public relations firms.
Yeah, and lobbyists. But yeah, the politicians are working with the PR firms, and the lobbyists are the ones feeding the politicians, and it's a whole sick cycle. And it goes back to Buckley versus Viejo, the Supreme Court decision that said money is speech, and First National Bank of Boston versus Bilotti, the Supreme Court decision that said that interest groups can contribute money to political campaigns and can run outside programs, and all these weird interpretations of the First Amendment by the Supreme Court that frankly I think need to be, I don't know if they can be legislatively overdone or if, you know, by amendment, or we just need a new Supreme Court. And you know, hopefully if we can get a Democrat in office and we can get some good progressive members on the court, we could reinvent something like the Warren Court. But
I'm glad you agree that Mukasey should be impeached. Thank you.
Yes, you're welcome. Thank you, Gene. I don't just agree. I would make a job one. I mean, the day that he said that he was not going to take the contempt of Congress citation for Harriet Myers and Josh Bolton would have been the day, if I was in Congress, that I would have been calling for his impeachment, and the day that I was calling for his impeachment on this program. Andre in South Carolina. Hey, Andre, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Just great. What's up?
Well, I have a kind of a different take on why the Democrats may be so hesitant in prosecution. I'm sure you're familiar with the continuity of government plan.
Yeah. Yes, this plan that the Bush administration, well, actually, it goes back to before the Eisenhower administration. It got really built up strongly under the Eisenhower administration during the Cold War about what do we do if a nuclear bomb takes out Washington, D.C.
Absolutely. Now, this plan was implemented on 9/11, and go to, like, page 38 of the 9/11 commission, you'll see Stephen Hadley, the national security advisor at the time for the White House, asking for the implementation of this continuity of government. We've not seen it rescinded or revoked, however. And, you know, it goes to why members of Congress would say one thing.
No, wait a minute. He asked for the implementation of it, but it has not been implemented, has it?
Oh, yes. It was implemented on 9/11 at 9:59 a.m.
The full provisions of the continuity of government program, where elections are suspended, police forces are federalized, new chains of command are instituted. No, I don't think so, Andre. I think things would be quite different if that was the case. I get it that people might, you know, you could build a case that members of Congress are afraid that Bush, you know, that along with some of his other executive orders, and going back to Nixon, by the way, is going to pull the plug. But still, I don't think that that's, you know, being afraid of those things is not sufficient, in my opinion, to not stand up to abuses of power and violations of the Constitution. It's just that simple. You stand on principle. Coming up Wednesday, I'll be confronting conservative scholar and author Dr. John Lott about his defense of big oil, his recent op-ed piece, No Profits, No Oil. And Howard Ruff is going to stop by. How to Prosper During the Coming Bad Years in the 21st Century, his new book. I used to read Howard Ruff back in the 70s. And, of course, the best of the rest of the news. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Call the Judiciary Committee today. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You are listening to Tom Hartman.
For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.